Joe Esterhaz was considered, even boasted of being, just about the baddest of the Hollywood bad boys. He drank from breakfast, did drugs during day and night, chased other men's wives with abandon. Along the way, he earned an estimated $30 million by writing screenplays. Some, like The Music Box, are considered classics. Some, like, let's say, Showgirls, Basic Instinct, Jagged Edge, are considered classic examples of Hollywood sleaze, violent, graphic, often nasty. Now Joe Esterhaz has written what many will consider his most improbable story. Shortly after moving back to his boyhood home of Cleveland, Joe Esterhaz developed throat cancer. In his struggle to survive and come to terms with himself, he turned to God and became a church-going, cross-bearing Christian. His newest book is called Crossbearer, A Memoir of Faith. Joe Esterhaz joins us from our studios in New York. Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Should we explain your voice, by the way?
Yes. In 2001, I had surgery for throat cancer. 80% of my larynx was removed. The only reason I can speak is because the Cleveland Clinic did a radical experimental surgery where they took the muscles from the left side of my neck and attached them to what was left of my larynx. I couldn't speak for about 2 years, and I sounded very much like Brando in The Godfather. I had a trach for a very long time, but my voice has improved. And incidentally, I want to tell you, Scott, that I'm often complimented, especially by women, on the sexiness of my voice today. And my response is, you have no idea what I had to do to get here, but thank you very much.
Well, I was intrigued in reading your book that at one point you thought that maybe throat cancer was some kind of divine punishment for some of the things you'd said over the years.
Well, I always had such a big, nasty, and usually obscene mouth that I would scatter with various F-bombs and other forms of really tough expression. And when this happened, I thought, well, there, you really are paying the price, you know, for all of those years of firing that kind of stuff at people. I don't think that now. I think God is forgiving and God is loving and good. But I certainly thought about it for a while.
How did God enter your life? Could you recreate that for us?
In the most desolate moment of my life, which was shortly after my surgery, my doctors told me that I had to stop drinking and smoking or else I'd die. I started smoking when I was 12 years old and drinking when I was 14. I was at that particular point in 2001, I had been the classic functional alcoholic. Both smoking and drinking were tied into my writing, whether it was sipping white wine or coffee laced with cognac. I didn't think I could do this. A month out after my surgery, I hadn't had a cigarette or a drink in that time, but all of my nerve endings were a jangle. I had no patience with either my wife or my children. All I thought about, I was obsessed by the notion of having a drink or a cigarette. I walked each day to try to ease my cravings a bit. But on this particular day, a warm day in Cleveland, I went out walking and it was 90-some degrees. I still had my trach in my throat. I was sweating and shaking. I couldn't breathe. In the worst and most desolate moment of my life, I sat down on a curb and I started to cry. I cried like I cried when I was a little boy, actually watching my tears fall to the pavement. And I suddenly heard a voice inside me that said, please, God, help me. I knew I couldn't have said it because I couldn't speak at all, but I kept hearing this voice, please, God, help me, please, God, help me. I stopped crying. I stopped shaking. I felt a sense of peace and solace. I opened my eyes, and for the first time, I thought, yes, I can do this with God's help. I can essentially win over my own self with God's help. I'm 7 years down the line, and I think my faith has deepened, and prayer and my faith, except for my wife and for my children, is at the very core of who I am. It really was a transformational experience. The reason I wrote the book is that I made a promise to God that if he would help me through this period, I would tell the world about it.
You note in the book at one point that looking back on it, God saved your life many times over the years. You just didn't see it that way at the time.
Well, I came to this country. I grew up in, my first 6 years were spent in Austrian refugee camps, first German, then English, and then American camps. We came to the United States, my mom, my dad, and I, when I was six. And I grew up on Cleveland's near west side. We were very poor. We were an immigrant family. You either had to fight your way through to get to the bus stop or negotiate. And sometimes I've said that I learned my greatest lessons about Hollywood right in front of Nick's Diner, you know, as I got to the school bus each day.
So what happened when Joe Esterhaz went back to Hollywood on business? And you were wearing a cross, right?
I was wearing a small silver cross. And, you know, a lot of people who had known me before looked at me agape. Some people thought that I completely lost my mind. Some of them said, look, you're going through a stage, and they brought Bob Dylan up to me with his conversion, and, you know, in those years when he did Christian music, and they said, well, you know, Dylan went through his period, so you'll go through your period, too, and then we could go back to making money again. You know, I said, I don't think so, guys. This is the most important thing that's happened in my life, and of course I want to keep doing screenplays, and I want to keep writing books, but I really don't want to write the kind of screenplay that I wrote before. So we'll see what happens. You know, I tried a script about St. Paul, and there was no interest in that. In terms of getting the kind of script made that I'm talking about now, a script that reflects my faith, I think that's going to be very difficult, because I do think that there is a kind of anti-Christian prejudice in Hollywood that is very tough to crack through. I used to say that Hollywood runs on greed, and that if the phone book gets, quote, hot, then they would film the phone book and put it up on screen. But, you know, even after the success of The Passion of the Christ and of Narnia, which indicates a gigantic, quote, market for Christian films, to put it in Hollywood terms, you know, whenever there's another kind of hit movie, and it's happened to me three times, they do 20 imitations of that movie until they totally burn it out. And after I did Flashdance, they did all dance pictures for a while. Jagged Edge courtroom thrillers, Basic brought in that kind of sultry thriller. You don't see that money train running on the Salvation track, even though it's been proven that there is a gigantic faith-based market.
Joe, what do you say to people, and maybe they don't say it to you directly, that what you're going through is just grief reaction?
Well, I'm 7 years down the line since I found God, and I think my faith has deepened. I've done a terrific amount of reading and trying to understand concepts of God. I spend a good part of each day in prayer. And the only thing I can really say is I know what it is that I feel. I know what's in my heart. And I know how I feel now as opposed to how I felt before. I think that everyone who has gone through a kind of transformational experience like I have will understand immediately what I'm talking about. But it's very difficult to explain that to those who haven't.
And why? I ask you as a novelist and screenwriter.
Because ultimately, Scott, we're talking about faith. We're talking about what's in the deepest part of our hearts and souls. And it really comes down to faith and belief. And if you dissect that purely with logic, you are led back to the wall that is what we call the mystery of faith. And that, of course, will always remain a great mystery. Some people find a faith and others don't.
What makes you sure God exists?
The best evidence to me is really what happened to me. Because without God's help, I knew I couldn't have done what I ultimately did.
Joe, thanks so much for all of your time.
Oh, Scott, thank you. It was terrific.
Joe Esterhaz, his new book is Crossbearer, A Memoir of Faith. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In times of economic torment, some people still figure new ways to make money, sometimes even off the torment. A French publisher has released a new comic book about Jérôme Crevilles, the young French trader blamed for the biggest trading loss in banking history. Société Générale lost about $7.1 billion through the unauthorized trading positions Mr. Crevilles had taken and concealed with fake hedges. I don't mean garden hedges. but he's considered a sympathetic character in much of France. He rose to prominence without attending any of France's elite schools, and polls show that almost 80% of the population consider him a victim of class prejudice. The new comic book shows Mr. Creville feeling snubbed for his modest clothes and regional accent, eating frozen dinners while he fathoms schemes to fool his superiors for overlooking his shrewdness. Interest in the book is so intense the publisher is doubling its printing. Maybe a lot of Lehman Brothers executives are ordering the book for Christmas.
Back now with Day to Day. Why read when you can listen? The business of audiobooks is a booming one. $1 billion worth of audiobooks were sold last year. That's 15% of all retail dollars in the book business overall. Part of the appeal of audiobooks are celebrities. Publishers often hire top-notch voiceover talent, famous stage actors, big-name authors, even the occasional movie star. As Nate DeMeo reports, sometimes great literature turns into not-so-great audiobooks.
Let's start with the gold standard.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Jim Dale's reading of the Harry Potter series amounts to a 115-hour masterclass in audiobook narration, and not just because of his pleasing tone and delightful Britishness. Dale has mastered the all-too-rare skill of distinguishing between characters without relying on wacky voices.
You do it, then, if you're so clever, Ron snarled. Hermione rolled up the sleeves of her gown, flicked her wand, and said, Wingardium Leviosa!
The guy moves so artfully from Ron to Hermione to Gilderoy Lockhart. It should be the platonic ideal for all school librarians and bedtime story readers. And that, in essence, is what the audiobook listener wants. Someone to read them a story, not act out a book. If only more audiobook producers felt that way. Audiobooks are bedeviled by gender and race, sort of like a swing state opinion poll. A hammy female narrator gruffing down her voice to do a noir tough guy is just not intimidating. And there's nothing less sexy than a femme fatale voice by a dude in falsetto.
What'd you do there? She asked. Nothing to talk to a lady about, Kelly replied. What makes you think I'm a lady?
While this bad gender bending can be annoying, racial drag can be offensive. Case in point, Sudhir Venkatesh's well-reviewed book, Gang Leader for a Day. The sociologist spent a decade in a decaying housing project in Chicago, a world most Americans only know from crime statistics or Hollywood stereotypes. But the audiobook is all Hollywood stereotypes. The reader is a white actor named Reg Rogers, and nearly every character is black. Unwisely, he tries to bring a little sound of the street to his reading. And it seems to be a street occupied by mid-1960s Sidney Poitier.
C-Note was challenging my authority, J.T. answered calmly. I had told him months before he couldn't do his work out there, and he told me he understood. He went back on his word, and I had to do what I had to do.
And so a book that is probably a great read becomes an audiobook that's nearly unlistenable. But mercifully, the last hour is read by the author himself. And Venkatesh is no professional voice actor, so he just reads you a story, without bombast or bad accents. And it reminds you that the people he's writing about are real, and not Hollywood caricatures.
When I asked T-Bone how he felt about the future, he soberly described his vulnerability as a lieutenant to JT. I'm not protected, that's my main problem, he said. I got nothing, so I have to be real careful. I mean, I save my money and give it to my mom. Like I told you, I want to get my degree and do something else with my life. Start a business, maybe.
Publishers are increasingly turning to Hollywood to bring a little star power to the nerdiest of industries. Matt Damon, Kevin Spacey, Sean Penn. Here's Brad Pitt trying out his Espanol in the audiobook of All the Pretty Horses.
An old man sat quietly against the wall, watching them. De que crimen que ha acusado el joven, he said. The man blinked. Assassinato, he said.
The skills required to narrate an audiobook clearly aren't necessarily the ones that help open a movie. An audiobook is not a book. When you curl up with an audiobook, there's another person there while you drive to work or walk the dog. Who wants to be stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic with a guy doing funny voices? For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
L-O-L P-911 A-Y-S. Don't know those abbreviations? Then you're probably not a teenager with extra strong thumbs that come with an addiction to text messaging. So here are some students from Chicago's Curie High School Youth Radio Project to take you into the world of texting, RN. And by the way, that means right now.
What you doing?
LOL, I guess you're sleeping.
I like your shirt. I'm bored.
What we should be doing is...
our work for the project.
What are we actually doing?
Texting about parties.
I think it's because we like to be in communication all the time with other people. Like, we like the interaction.
And when you're at school, you get less bored.
Okay, this one, it says, laugh out loud, where you at? And it's a friend, and they're in the lunchroom with me. It's kind of like we just joke around sometimes.
I either text my mom and ask her if she's coming to pick me up, or I text my boyfriend and ask him what color is he wearing to school tomorrow.
In one classroom with 30 kids, 30 students, I think at least a good 90% text.
Do you think the teacher knows you're texting?
No. It's very funny sometimes, though, because we're, like, texting right in front of her. Like, I can't believe she doesn't hear the clicking of the buttons. And when it vibrates when we receive a new message, it's like the whole classroom hears it except her.
They think they're very sly. But the window, the cell phone window, is illuminating.
I just really look back at elementary school compared to high school. You know, I still remember passing notes with my friends and, you know, being careful that you couldn't hear the paper crinkle or that, you know, the teacher would see you and catch you and then read the note out loud. And
you just put your book bag on top of the desk and you start texting or...
like hiding it under the notebooks.
In my seventh period class, I always text with one of my friends. And then one time, the teacher, she caught us and she took away my phone. But I asked for it after class, so she gave it back to me. She told me not to do it again, but I kept on doing it anyway.
Because I got unlimited, so I'd be texting all day.
You think I can borrow $20, please? I'll promise to get it back to you ASAP.
What, sir, are you kidding?
LOL.
It's destroying two things, the ability to speak and the stupid abbreviations. People have bad enough grammar and English as it is without finding new ways to make it worse.
OMG.
WTF, where are you?
The best way to communicate with people is talk. I'm saying just pick up the phone and just call me.
Nah, I'll just text.
LOL. That piece was produced by the students of Chicago's Curie High School Youth Radio Project.